What makes therapy work? Science or art? Let's see. First of all, I would answer the question by saying science and art and something else. Let's say science and art and humanness. Psychotherapy has to do with a transmission of something very complex, a transmission that you can't say it's cultural. I once wrote, speaking of Gestalt, that there is a passing on of a life philosophy, a way of looking at things, but I don't think that's enough either. We would do better by saying a transmission of consciousness. There are people who are more conscious than other people because they have worked on their minds. And part of that is self-knowledge. And somebody who has knowledge of self has a better knowledge of others too. And this never feels like having attained the point of now I know it, now I have it, but still there is a sense where whoever is like wine that has more aging, this leavening passes on from one person to another. I don't think it's exclusive to psychotherapy. I think it has to do with friendship too. It would be to professionalize things too much to say therapy is a unique, separate creation that we have come up with. Maybe what we have come up with is putting a label. I think Thomas Sass thinks of the same way. There is a learning through interaction, through dialogue, that happens in certain situations. Everybody who is in a love relationship knows that that is a school. That's an unavoidable learning. Anybody who's in a true friendship that is not friendship because you want to play tennis with somebody, or friendship because there is an erotic attraction, but friendship for itself. If we look at friendship of the pure kind, where friendship is true friendship, generally values are involved. I think the Greeks were very much on the... where they observed something real when they said there's always a young person who's trying to learn from an older person. And there's something like love in that. In the Greeks, it was erotized. But it doesn't have to be this. Like we feel certain people have something we want. We value in them something that we would like to have more of. So a lot of human interaction is like a learning process by osmosis, and by osmosis and by admiration. I think it works through devotion, appreciation, reverence, this kind of love that the Greeks called philia, which is not charity, it's not eros, neither eros nor agape, but philia. It's the kind of love prescribed by the Decalogue when it says love and respect your parents. Like a child is supposed to have respect to the parent. Of course, that has been deformed in patriarchal culture, in an authoritarian culture. But the essence of that is something comparable to what the chicks that follow the hen, like an imprinting, ducks and all kinds of birds. And it's biological. Studies have been done on how you can have, instead of a hen, a shoebox, and the shoebox becomes the mother, and some people have that kind of mothering. They They tend to follow the wrong object for the rest of their life, but they're imprinted by an artificial mother substitute that is not successful, and they seek and seek and seek. I think there is a seeking, and the child begins in a dyadic relation to the mother, and there's a third person out there, which is a father, which is a representative of the outside world, but the child sees the father as the person that the mother loves. The father is significant to the child. You could say the mother looks at the father or looks toward the father. So the child, we all as children, learn to look at the father as the representative of values, as the lighthouse. If the mother looks in that direction, the child is getting the breast from the mother, is getting all the goodies from the mother, but there's something valuable. Why is she looking in that direction? Why is she looking at the father? So the father becomes an authority because there is an impulse to follow. Only later this is degraded by the father saying, you love me, you obey me, you respect me. But essentially respect, veneration is something that is part of our nature, and when we lack it, we lose the magic of the world. We need to be able to be small to in order to see the bigness of others or the world. The ability to be enthusiastic about something depends on our ability to have this kind of devotion. And so there is this kind of following. And I think what makes somebody into a therapist is essentially that somebody called a patient feels here is somebody who has something. It's not just because there is a label and a person has gone through a university and has an accreditation. We choose our therapist when we feel here's somebody I can draw something from by contact. And this partly has to do through this emotion that is respect, or the sense of somebody being a little bit more evolved. We have a kind of consciousness thermometer. We have a sense of who's higher in the ladder. And this has nothing to do with the degree of pain or with the visible hang-ups of the other. Like a good therapist is one who can say, I have such and such problems, and doesn't have to hide these problems, and precisely the ability to be with them and to live with them and to be able to be honest about them makes him a better model of the kind of person who we all need to be, as somebody who doesn't have to be pretending. So if the goal of therapy is be more loving, you need to be in touch with somebody who has some love in his heart. If the goal of therapy is to be more free, you need to be in contact with somebody who has some freedom. If the goal of therapy is to get more authenticity, to be more real, you need to be in touch with somebody who doesn't just talk to you about authenticity, but models it. And so I think therapy is contagion. And contagion of what? I think essentially two things I would underline. I would say therapy is Dionysian, meaning by Dionysian not just hedonistic, but something much deeper. Dionysus is a god, and Dionysian religion was the oldest of the Greek religions. Before the Olympian gods, or before Dionysus entered the Olympus, he was the god of old Europe. It is now demonstrated that Dionysus in Greece is the same as Shiva in India, the archaic god. A god representing what? One approximation could be nature. naturalness. We have lived for centuries in a culture turned against desiring, in a culture of over-control, in a culture of mind over nature, the conquest of nature, not only outside nature, but conquest of inner nature, a culture where Freud found it necessary to make it part of his work to show people that they were animals as well. It was too much forgotten that humans are animals. It's not that we humans are only animals, but animal nature is part of what we are. It would be better that we integrate into our conscious mind. Of course, primitive peoples have not desecrated animal nature. This seems to have started with what we call civilization, like in the founding book of our civilization, the Western civilization, the book of Genesis. We find this very telling image of God telling Eve to put her heel over the head of the snake. You will put your heel over the snake. What is the snake? It's clearly demonized in Genesis. It's made the voice of the evil one. But since Marija Djambutas and other archaeologists, it's very clear that there was a culture where the supreme holy symbol was a snake. And the snake is a religious symbol, and it's not only Genesis has the tree and the snake, but other images of paradise, of the primeval garden, like in India, where also the tree is connected with the snake, but without the idea of the snake being the bad guy of the picture, but the snake being the voice of nature, the voice of the tree, the voice of instinct. We all have, you know, we say today we have a reptilian brain, but this reptilian brain is something we have disconnected with, except when somebody becomes integrated through psychotherapy to be more open to spontaneous impulses and desires, or ultimately in spiritual traditions, spiritual experiences, where the inner snake dramatically surfaces, where the awakening of the reptilian brain becomes what the Indians call the kundalini. So a shaman is a master of the snake, a master of fire, the inner fire, somebody who is has made friends with this deeper instinctual life, and the healing ability of the shaman comes from having reconnected with this part of ourselves that to us has become alien, but without which we are only partial humans. So when I say Dionysian, I imply that there is such a thing as not only organismic self-regulation, which is the expression that was introduced by Fritz Perls to mean what the Chinese mean by Tao. Not only is there organismic wisdom, not only is there instinctual wisdom or animal wisdom, but there is such a thing as organismic trust or faith, a faith in yielding to this deeper wisdom. I think a good therapist is a person who has more faith to navigate in ruffled waters. People have a limited tolerance for emotional outbursts. People are afraid of going too deep into emotions. psychotherapist is somebody who has less fear of chaos, less fear of the waves, more trust in the organismic process, and that if everything hangs out, truth will prevail in the end. If you let everything happen, the ends will not be destructive chaos, but a productive chaos, a self-organizing chaos. Now, Dionysus is a very great religious conception because, on the one hand, Dionysus is very similar to Christ. He's the son of Zeus, son of the father of the gods. On the other hand, he is persecuted. He's not just persecuted, he is killed. And he's resurrected. Interestingly, the myth of Dionysus ends with the words, and he is describing the entrance of this persecuted god at the end of his life, enters the Olympus, is received by the other assembled gods on top of Mount Olympus, and there he comes to sit at the right hand of the Father. Very Christian words. So it's very clear that the early Christians knew very well the myth of Dionysus. The mysteries of Dionysus were very present. Probably St. Paul was part of it. So was introduced. These words must have been introduced. It's too much a coincidence to introduce them for Christ. Now, the central symbol for Christianity is wine. And Dionysus is the inventor of wine. Why wine? What makes wine special? Wine is not produced by any tree. It's not a fruit of a product of nature. Neither bread nor wine are produced by nature. They are foods that result from a sort of decomposition. Decomposition that in the case of wine we call fermentation. And it goes, wine, the juice of the fruit, in this case the grape, goes a little bad. Nobody likes it at the beginning, and unless the process is guided a little bit. And so, in the end, there results from this fermentation something that not only has a taste that is very special, and that everybody seems to like very much, that it in which one can recognize levels of refinement. There are three things: bread, wine, and cheese that have this nature, and in cheeses also, which are result of putrefaction. You have all this refinement, culinary refinement, the expertise in the tasting of the different cheeses. And sometimes in literature, cheese is introduced with a similar intention as wine. Like in the Odyssey, you have Odysseus coming to the cave of the Cyclops. He almost dies. Some of his men will be eaten by the Cyclops. And the Cyclops has in his cave wine and cheeses. So it's the idea of transformation is carried by these special foodstuffs. So Dionysus is one who is transformed, an archetype of transformation, dying and being reborn in the contemporary Christian culture is something that people attribute to somebody who lived 2,000 years ago, and it happened only once in a literal sense. And Alan Watts, who knew very much about the inner life and religions in general, used to say the problem with Christianity that it's no longer the religion of Christ, it's a religion about Christ. But already in the Middle Ages, there was the notion that there was a saying, few come to Bethlehem, fewer yet come to Calvary. Bethlehem is a place of a new birth. So few people come to be reborn, to leave an old life behind, what is also symbolized in the Jewish story of Exodus, like the crossing of Red Sea. The old self is left behind. There's a time in life when you are not subject to Pharaoh any longer. You go on a long journey beyond. So few people, says this saying, few people come to Bethlehem, fewer yet come to Calvary, because the idea was alive in the Middle Ages that the Via Crucis is a way of every individual. We all need to bear the suffering of being in this life, the natural and unavoidable sufferings of being alive, and we have to find the right attitude to suffering. So Dionysus is a god very much like Christ, except that the Christian culture is a culture very inimical to the body, and the early Greek culture, as you can see from the art, is a culture where the artistic products, you don't see the human body with clothes very often. There's a preference for nudity. And this was part of everybody's life because everybody practiced. And women and men practiced gym and naked. Nudity was tells us how the inner life was much less, had not become what it came to be later in the Judeo-Christian tradition. So there is in the Dionysian world the idea of faith in desires, faith in wishing, a little bit like one can understand that a plant knows how to grow in the direction of the sun. We have learned to invalidate wishes or desires as if their rational mind knows better. And instead of thinking we have an animal mind in ourselves that has part of the answers to what we're looking for. There are certain things that only the inner animal can tell us, like in some fairy tales when the hero has to let the horse lead him to where the next step is, an idea that the horse knows more than the rider where it needs to go. We have lost this. So I think therapy, without knowing what it has been doing, has been revalidating because of its scientific basis. Like you take a person like Freud. Freud was not quite a believer in instinct yet. He discovered repression, but he laid more emphasis on the cognitive side of repression. He didn't emphasize so much the curtailment of spontaneity. That's more implicit in Freudian psychology. It was Wilhelm Reich and his contemporary D.H. Lawrence, beyond the world of therapy, who made it clear. It's a war between natural impulses, a war between eros and civilization. Freud didn't get to the point of being a revolutionary who questioned the sanity of civilization. Now practically everybody does, at least since the 60s, in the phenomenon of the 60s, the phenomenon of the countercultural mind is a massive agreement on the part of young people especially that the culture as a whole was on the wrong track. There was a wrongness or sickness about it. Now we are, I think, our modern times, the world of neoliberalism and neoconservatism, has been built on the reverse of the 60s. I think the 60s, on the one hand, was a very generative age where there was ecology and civil rights and feminism and so many movements bringing along with the resurrection, the proliferation of new therapies and the interest in Orientalism and the Eastern approaches, all this at the same time as if obviously a great creativity, but it represented a great danger to the system. And I think at every family, the generation gap was such that the parents felt insulted by their sons, and the degree of independence of thought of their sons generated enough anger for politicians to draw on in their political campaigns. And I think the youth of the 60s was treated like, with a conscious strategy, like Hitler did with the Jews. It's them. They are the, let's fight the hippies. They are the danger to the country. They are the un-American people and so forth. I was a witness of the Reagan campaign in California when I was here on a Guggenheim fellowship at UC. And so it is as if this voice had to be repressed and something completely opposite created. We have the most un-Dionysian culture today, the most unspontaneous, most uptight culture, and it's a bad taste to be so retrograde as to look like hippies looked, like they didn't care to cut their hair so well, or like all these external signs of not caring about externals. Going to the main thing I want to say, I think therapy, because of the scientific outlook of Freud and Reich, believed in instinct and observed the curtailment of instinct and began to turn into the service of instinct until it became self-conscious. And some people made it into a goal of therapy, recovery of spontaneity, like Moreno with psychodrama. It is a goal of psychodrama, the recovery of spontaneity, education of spontaneity. In others, therapies is more implicit, like a free association, you could say, is a great, like Maslow said, free association is a Taoistic exercise. Letting the mind flow without interference is something that has value beyond interpretations. And it's particularly in the intersubjective context. Of course, things happen there. It's a learning situation where people learn to be more truthful and express themselves more spontaneously, and nothing bad happens, and there's a saying in Spanish, to know is to love. The more more intimately you know somebody, there is a fear of intimacy, because if I show my dirty laundry, you're not going to love me. If I show in therapy the things I really need to show, this is risky. But it happens in situations of greater spontaneity, like free association, independently of therapeutic context. And I've used it a lot in the life of groups, as an ingredient in the life of groups, to have people do practice a lot of free association. More and more love grows between people through this sharing intimacy about whatever comes up, without any pretension of, I know more than you, I'll tell you this, I'll be the detective who tells you what's behind your free association. So one ingredient of therapy, I say, is this Dionysian attitude of allowing for what comes spontaneously, allowing for desires, allowing for wishes, decriminalizing desire. Today we think we have sexual freedom, but we have enough pornography to suspect that this is the other side of a lack of freedom. There's freedom on one level, behavioral freedom maybe, but not the freedom to feel or the freedom to go with this, with the expression of desire, or to be present in the moment of spontaneous sexual expression. So a child has said so many times, is told, no, 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 don't, that therapy has, among other things, this function of decriminalizing, let's say, it, for the recovery of the ability to people to know what they want, when they want it, and to be able to express it without shame, without guilt, and live more in accordance with such wants of the animal subself. That's one side of therapy. Now, Nietzsche, in his book, The Origin of Tragedy, drew a lot of attention to the polarity of Dionysus and Apollo in Greek mythology. There's Dionysus is the god of surrender, the god of immersion. You go into a situation, you don't have to think about it, you become it. You don't look at it from a distance. Apollo is the god that looks at things from a distance. Apollo shoots his arrows from a distance. And distance gives clarity. Distance allows for discrimination. Immersion does not allow for clarity. Immersion leads to a kind of knowing by becoming. If I say, become this person in your dream, you will learn something about that person in your dream by becoming it and recognize something of yourself in it, undo some of your projection onto that dream image. But that's the Dionysian attitude, become it. Apollonian is looking from afar. Apollo represents in the Greek mythology something a little bit like Buddhist consciousness. Apollo is neutrality. Apollo is in some sense dispassion. You would say Dionysus is passion, Apollo is dispassion. The story of Apollo is Apollo was very much like his father, Zeus. Very patriarchal god. Zeus would rape all the women and all the goddesses. It was part of the prerogative of his great power. And Apollo was a little bit like him, and who would get in struggles with his father, Zeus. But he was punished, and he made to serve a king. And he had to bend. And then he was sent to the mysteries of the goddess to be redeemed. And in the end, Apollo becomes the god of balance. He's represented as a youth that evokes the sense of a perfect body. But we can read this metaphorically to mean a harmonious being. How does neutrality connect with harmony? Because it is this neutrality of pure awareness which is the field in which contradictions can be worked out. Apollo becomes the god of music for the same reason. Music is harmony. Harmony comes from balance. But the idea of these arrows of Apollo is that these arrows kill monsters. There's a connection between Apollo and medicine also. it's not only, it's appropriate that I'm claiming that Apollo is very much present. It's an implicit god of psychotherapy. But because already in the ancient times, Apollo was regarded as a purifier and as a connected to medicine and somebody who killed monsters. Like if you saw or read Oedipus, the famous play that so much inspired Freud, Oedipus is presented at the beginning of the play as a great king who has done great deeds, and he is beloved by his people and trusted because he has solved the riddle of the Sphinx, and he has almost civilized people, and he is unequal to anybody. And there is a plague in the land, and the people come to him for help with this plague. And his reaction is, oh yes, I want to help. The first thing to be done is to consult the oracle of Apollo. Consulting the oracle of Apollo was appropriate, not just because the oracle is the voice of wisdom, but because there's a plague, and Apollo is the purifier of plagues. And why was Freud so impressed by Oedipus? One might think that because he saw his own Oedipal situation, his own closeness to his mother, or his sense of guilt about loving his mother too much and inappropriately, and resenting his father for owning her too much. One might think, and I think Freud thought that was the reason. I think he was confused. I am the opinion that the reason why he was so impressed by Oedipus, that he didn't formulate it. It was a displacement of his thought into the Oedipal similarity. I think originally it's because Oedipus says, I will help the people, I want to find the truth about this. And his attitude, when it started to become, the facts began to point at him as the cause, as the culprit. There was somebody who had killed his father, and he didn't know that he had killed his father. It's true that he had killed a man who very arrogantly told him to get out of the way, and he didn't. And his foot was hurt, and he in a burst of revenge, pulled the reins, and the man was thrust out of the car and dragged by the horses and killed. This was part of his past, but he didn't know he had killed his father. He didn't know that who his father was. He thought his father was somebody else. He had grown with foster parents and didn't know this. So there was a determination that he will find the truth no matter what. And that resembles the situation of the seeker, of somebody who's after the truth, whatever the consequence, who's willing to suffer the consequences of finding out. I think Freud identified with that attitude. And then secondarily, yes, there was this Oedipal thing, which he thought was universal. Today, not many people think the Oedipal situation is universal, like the situation which is universal is the need for love and the frustration of love in the child, and some children sexualize it, other people experience it in different ways. I was saying Apollo is a purifier, and the purification has to do, what does it Apollo represent? Apollo is just a symbol, like Dionysus is a symbol. Dionysus represents madness. It's madness divinized, the recognition of a greatness of going beyond the boundaries of sanity. And the greatness of trusting that madness is self-healing. There's a like just like it's heuristic to live out one's mistakes, because if we explore our mistakes, we will be corrected. If we experiment with our wrong assumptions consciously, we will be able to transcend them. Something like that with madness too. There is a sort of living out of our madness that is part of our life. And some people can go there dramatically through that of finding themselves that allowing themselves to live a nearly psychotic assumption about themselves, like a grandiosity or a crypto-messianism or whatever, and then get over it by getting it out. So that's what Dionysus represents, madness. What Apollo, by contrast, represents is complete sobriety. Sobriety is dispassion. And where can we find dispassion in our lives? Huh? In the DSM? As a clinical syndrome? Oh, the DSM is dispassionate. Science, when it said that science has no, is valueless, but it has a Apollonian, you could say, implicit Apollonian bias. Yes. You could say that's a kind of half-baked dispassion. There is a deeper dispassion that can solve problems. This half-baked dispassion gets us stuck in a cold world. We live in a dehumanized world where we tend to become numbers and digits and statistics and non-attachment. We are Gestalt therapists here. I don't know whether there are other Gestalt therapists in this room, but now I forgot your name. Steve Schoen and I are Gestaltists and with an interest in Buddhism. And I forgot what I was going to say about that. I forgot it. Let me start from scratch. Or let me go back to Buddhist awareness. When practicing meditation, but not only in practicing meditation. I was in the Gurdjieff work, for instance. I don't know whether anybody has contact with the Gurdjieff culture. There, the word disidentification was used very much. Don't identify. Like if you're watching a movie, don't forget that it's a movie. You're here, sitting here. Don't go so much into the movie that you forget yourself. If you walk along a street, you may be eaten up by the store windows that you look at. You're window shopping, and every window you look at with desire. And in this interest, we are not able to look at the object and stay aware of ourselves as subject at the same time. Probably as children, we're talked by adults, by our parents, in such a way that we felt that we had to pay attention in a way that was like getting out of ourselves. Like, pay attention to what I'm telling you. I remember reading in Gesell, in this famous book on child development, that sometimes six-year-olds may fall out of deep interest in what they're looking at. They may look at something with such intent that their knees may bend of concentration. So that kind of interest, I think, we lose. We are all educated in idiocy by schools and by grown-ups telling us, listen to what I will tell you. instead of the Socratic model of the teacher being somebody who is able to be a role model of not knowing, somebody who tells the student in answer to a question, I don't know, let's find out. The teacher feels in the obligation to tell him, no, you don't have it right. Listen to me, I'll tell you. And if the student rewords it in a way that doesn't fit the words that originally said, that is not valid. And the kind of testing used in schools tests repetition, not understanding. So, again, how I go, do I get back to Buddhist awareness? We lose the sense of subject through over-identification, and all spiritual approaches teach non-attachment, which is non-identification to this or that. Not identification. Body awareness, yes. Feeling awareness, yes. Awareness of what we think, yes. But also a deeper awareness, which is very rare, which is awareness of awareness. Awareness of somebody looking. Awareness without awareness without an object. It is so rare that this is not registered in the books of academic philosophy. Awareness, since Brentano onwards, is supposed to be intentional. Awareness always has an object, supposedly. According to spiritual traditions, no. There is a dissolution of the object. There's no subject and no object. Can you understand this? Intrinsic awareness, it's called in Buddhism. So the way of Apollo is the mystery of an awareness which is unlike the awareness of our hunting self, our avid itself is interested in this, interested in that, is interested in grasping. Our lower nature is homo faber, the doer. Our mind, we're very much connected to our eye and our hand, a grabbing self. Our ordinary self is a grabbing self. And spiritual evolution seems to involve a letting go of this grabbing and going to more into a gratuitous state. Krishnamurti used to call it choiceless awareness. What is it good for? For nothing. For nothing but itself. But it's part of the restoration of neutrality, the restoration of creative indifference, as it was put by Salomo Friedlander, who had an influence on Fritz Perls, is healing. The Dionysian way heals through madness, the Apollonian way heals through creative indifference, through a high level of neutrality that looks at things and says, interesting. Interesting is an interesting word because it's not exactly indifference. When there is no grabbing, where there's no self-interest, there's another kind of interest that appears. The world becomes interest for itself. If we empty ourselves in a way, everything becomes radiant. If we are more empty of our mental processes, the world becomes more interesting. Other people become more interesting. So there was a religion of Apollo. There were mysteries of Apollo. The minor mysteries were the mysteries of Apollo in the ancient world. The mystery is connected with self-knowledge, and the major mystery is connected to the rebirth, connected with death and rebirth. And there were the mysteries of the mother, but Dionysus was very much part of those mysteries, from what we know. So I have the feeling that psychotherapy is echoing the pattern of the ancient mysteries without knowing it. We are rediscovering certain things about life. We are rediscovering self-knowledge, which was already very present to the mysteries, because we all know how Socrates' life was inspired by the inscription on the Delphic Oracle and the instructions given to him by Diotima, his teacher, and the Sibyl as the oracle. Socrates declared this, is well known. Sibyl told me, examine people and what do they know. Make it a guideline of your life to know yourself and help others live an examined life. So self-knowledge was highly prized. Today we have many pictures of Socrates and books on Socrates. Somehow we have built a large monument to Socrates in our inner city, in the city of our collective mind, but we don't heed what he believed in or what he said. We don't have schools that help people to know themselves. People, when they go to school, have to forget themselves and become more robotic than ever. It would seem that it's done purposely to create to have a manipulated democracy where everybody is receptive to what TV indicates, or the experts talking about all the issues of the day on TV. The Socratic mind would be a bit dangerous today, of people being independent and knowing themselves in the first place. So there's these two ways of healing that converge. How can opposites converge? How can the way of knowledge converge with the way of surrender? This way of surrender doesn't ask questions. The way of immersion just follows inspiration. It's a way of inspiration and the way of reflection. In fact, they are. Anybody who, for instance, in Gestalt therapy, you could say 50% of is Dionysian. A lot of Gestalt therapy is like, I used to think of Fritz Perls as an apostle of Dionysus, as an apostle of this faith of be your own self, live from your heart, let's say. And 50% Apollonian, because there was an element of de-dramatization. If somebody was in tears about some event in the past, he would say, okay, how much longer do you want to weep about it? How much more do you want to be in turmoil about what happened to you when you were little? There is always an invitation to be in the present and to recognize that in the present you can drop the past, that the past has ceased to exist. Everything is here. And if you are really in the present, not only can you drop the past, if at the heart of the present you can drop content, you can drop issues. At the heart of the present you find yourself, or you find something that is not even yourself. You find being. This sense of presence has a filling quality that is intrinsically therapeutic beyond any kind of problem resolution. So you could say therapy helps people restore awareness. Originally, Freud was using awareness like somebody who uses a torch to illumine the past. Then with Reich, it started to be more light on the ongoing situation in therapy. But I think today we have come to understand that light is something that needs to be restored for itself. That once you find the light, it's like finding a reality that nourishes us beyond our little world. So in that sense, I would say to the question therapy or art, religion, but in our meaning of religion, so different from the Christian religion that this can be grasped if we consider that Dionysian religion that was so holy to the Greeks, so respected to the Greeks, was so far from being recognized a religion by the Western world that Dionysus became the model for the devil. The image of Dionysus with his horns and the proximity of the snake and the bull, all these images, and the tail, and images connected to the mythology of Dionysus were in the first place considered just mythology, in the second place demonized. And Apollo also became just mythology. So I think if we consider deeply therapy, what therapy is, it is self-knowledge and freedom, self-knowledge and spontaneity, regaining of these two. And if we use these names, that doesn't seem spiritual. Spontaneity seems something compatible with biological language, freeing instinct, or freeing the inner child. Perhaps this can be said without any spiritual context to it. And if you speak of self-knowledge, you could also speak of self-knowledge without making it into anything spiritual. However, I think that when the Greeks made Dionysus into a god, they were implying that the heart of awareness is spiritual. It has a greatness to it that surpasses a concept like spontaneity and surpasses a concept like self-awareness or self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is academic. Apollo, what does Apollo have that is more than self-knowledge? Apollo is a quality of awareness, is awareness that is so much non-attached that liberates. And from that non-attachment sees grotesqueness for what it is. When it's said that he is a god that purifies with his arrows, that kills monsters with his arrows, it's a way of speaking metaphorically of the fact. If we are well aware, if we are conscious, we see human aberration without ever trying. The man who wrote this book, what's the name? I quoted Friedlander, Creative Indifference, the man who Fritz said it was the only person he had venerated in his life. Today I am more jet-lagged than yesterday. This man, Friedlander, came to his clarity through a great struggle against his sexuality, because he was a disciple of Schopenhauer and believed in doing without desires. He was very sexual and believed in transcending that. And when he gained this awareness, he became also an artist. And he had a pseudonym, Minona, which is anonym in reverse. He had a double personality, one who wrote philosophical things, and another who wrote what he called grotesquen. He made caricatures in many magazines. So he had this gift of seeing wrongness. And I think anybody who's a little bit more awake, who's more aware, has the gift of seeing the other as caricature, to seeing aberration, to seeing wrongness, and this we could call diagnosis. But it's a gift to be able to reflect somebody else what's off. Any Zen master has this gift of seeing where the other person is off. It doesn't come from therapeutic culture. If you are awake to something, that you perception of that wrongness is already the beginning of knowledge, and it's a gift to pass on. I think I won't make an end. I'm told that it's time, more or less. I'll leave it here.